Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Major winter storms saw flooding across Sacramento County, along with down power lines and trees. If you head south on Highway 99, you'll find the town of Wilton, located just east of Elk Grove, which has had its fair share of flooding throughout the years and decades. And this round of storms was no different. The town of roughly 6,000 received a rotation of evacuation warnings and orders, but many residents chose to stay. Instead of evacuating, choosing to do their own assessment and self-determining if it was best to remain in place. CAP Radio Sacramento government reporter Kristen Lamb spoke with those who call Wilton home to learn more about why many chose not to evacuate. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning, Vicky.
So for those who are not familiar with the Wilton area, describe it.
Wilton is in southern Sacramento County, east of Elk Grove. It has a population of about 6,000 people. The Cosumnes River lies along Wilton. The river doesn't have any dams, and levees on it are designed for agriculture. As of November 2022, the typical home value in Wilton is about $950,000.
Yeah, and you went down there. These properties are significantly larger than what we would think in a city.
Yeah, you know, like properties with farms, a couple of acres kind of thing.
So given Wilton is along the Cosumnes River and a river that doesn't have dams or levees on it, what is the history with flooding and the damage in that area?
Yeah, so I know you were reporting in the field during Wilton's 2017 flood. The county also confirmed that Wilton flooded in 1997, 1986, and 1982. I spoke with Mike Luna, who was born in Wilton in 1955, and told me that very year a flood wiped out the Freeman Bridge, which used to connect to Elk Grove. During the 1997 flood, his mom actually evacuated. That year, floodwaters came into their family house. It reached about a foot high, despite sandbags. For comparison, Luna said his home hadn't flooded as of last week.
Okay, well, that's good news. With the recent series of extreme weather in the Wilton area, how many evacuation warnings and orders did residents go through in the past few weeks?
Since New Year's Eve, the Wilton area has received 2 evacuation orders, 3 evacuation warnings, and 1 shelter-in-place order. The first warning and shelter-in-place order came December 31st. Shelter-in-place was lifted after 6 days. Then 2 days later, on January 8th, Sacramento County gave another evacuation warning and order. They lifted them on January 10th. Then this past Saturday, Wilton residents again got evacuation warning and order. The order was lifted Sunday and the warning ended yesterday.
Yeah, so it was just like back to back. When it comes to these orders and warnings, what's the difference between an evacuation order and an evacuation warning?
So a warning comes first. It means there's a potential threat to life or property. And people who need extra time, including those who own pets or livestock, should leave now. That's according to Samantha Motz, a spokesperson for the county. Versus an evacuation order means there's an immediate threat to life or property. It's a lawful order, meaning people need to leave an area. Mott says if you don't follow an evacuation order, there are risks, especially considering roads get flooded in Wilton. Here's Mott explaining potential consequences.
Those who choose to stay and not evacuate could become cut off from the community. There were a lot of power outages in that area, and we can't predict how long an evacuation order could stay in place. So if they need help or they need medical help, the medics may not be able to get there.
So on the flip side, Kristen, there's also a shelter-in-place order, and Wilton residents receive that as well in the duration of these atmospheric rivers. What exactly is that?
That means there's a threat outside, and people should stay indoors to protect themselves. Whether officials issue this because of a flooding or shooting, the takeaway is pretty much the same. Mott said the county issued a shelter-in-place order New Year's Eve because the roads were unsafe. They didn't want people trying to evacuate in the dark when the rain was coming down hard. It was also really windy that night, as I'm sure a lot of us remember.
Yeah, it's not that far in our hindsight in the past. When you went out to Wilton and you talked to people asking whether they evacuated, what did they tell you?
Every person I interviewed or who sent me a message said they didn't evacuate. Longtime residents say they have experience with past flooding and how water levels rise. Some residents also told me that their houses aren't on floodplains designated by FEMA. Sean Houston has lived in Wilton since about 1960. He told me he's never evacuated during previous flooding, not even in 1986, when he watched part of a levee break from his bedroom window. He brought up this point that I heard multiple times.
Most people who've been here any length of time kind of know what the river's going to do, so they're used to it. And they already know what areas of their property are going to flood and what levels the water's going to get to, worst case scenario. So you let the land teach you instead of you trying to teach the land.
Okay, so as Houston mentioned, you know, people are used to flooding in the Wilton area. Did he elaborate more, or anyone in the Wilton area, about the thought process, how they decide when or when not to evacuate?
Megan Weatherford said she assessed her family's risks with her husband. She's a third-generation Wilton resident, but bought her property 4 years ago. So this is her first flood at that house. Weatherford told me the property isn't on a floodplain. She also considered her three children, goats, pig, chickens, dogs, and barn cats. Here's how she decided to stay instead of evacuating.
Number one was it wasn't safe. There were no safe exits for us. And where our locality was, there was a lot of down power lines. There was a lot of unknowns. So to evacuate and risk, you know, my kids' lives or our own getting stuck, and obviously we know what happened out on Dillard Road, and that was one of the evacuation routes, it really, you know, made me question whether or not that was a viable option. And then, you know, the second part is we didn't have anywhere to take our animals, so we really didn't feel comfortable leaving them behind with nothing. And so we just kind of assessed our risk and just kind of hunkered down and did what we could.
When she was talking about what happened on Dillard Road, was that someone who passed away?
Yeah, I believe officials found a body of someone off near Dillard Road and Highway 99, and I believe one of the other bodies that was also found in that area of the three people who died during the New Year's Eve storm.
So that weighed heavily into whether to leave or not leave for this resident, for Megan. Mm-hmm. What kind of damage did people experience for the residents who chose to stay behind?
Yeah, so Weatherford said the storm destroyed her farm. Two 200-foot trees crushed the barn. Rain flooded the chicken coop. A river formed on the back half of a property, covering about 3 acres with water as far as the eye can see. Fortunately, she said water didn't get into her house. And in an email, another person told me their house was temporarily an island because it was surrounded by floodwaters. Those eventually receded.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio reporter Kristen Lamb about the Sacramento community of Wilton and why some residents chose not to evacuate following orders due to flooding. So the county opens up evacuation centers, right? How does the county communicate those, and what resources are available there?
The county includes information about evacuation centers when it issues evacuation orders and warnings. You get those alerts via the county alert system and on your cell phone if you're in a certain area. The county also gives evacuation center information on social media. At centers, you can get meals, snacks, and don't have to sleep there if you go. I went to an evacuation center in Elk Grove last Monday. It wasn't very busy. A few people using the services that afternoon declined to do an interview, which is totally understandable.
Yeah, they're dealing with enough. Any idea of the usage rate of these centers?
For context, evacuation centers are open to everyone, at least ones ran by the Red Cross. So there's no requirement to be under an evacuation order to use it. A center was open at the Sacramento Asian Sports Foundation in Elk Grove from January 8th to 12th. The Red Cross told me 63 people used it during that time. And when it closed, everyone there had been experiencing homelessness since before the flooding. It's unclear how many people who evacuated from Wilton used the center. I didn't interview him for my reporting, but I know family of family evacuated from Wilton and stopped by that center. Another evacuation shelter at the Wackford Center was open from December 31st to January 8th. The county said 40 people used it during that time.
Okay, and when we're talking about evacuation centers and warnings and orders, it's not just isolated to flooding. It's to a variety of disasters. Did anyone you speak with evacuate for other natural disasters?
Yeah, Kathy Devote moved to Wilton in 2021 from Sonoma County, where she evacuated her horses three times for wildfires. She rides horses competitively. But Devote didn't evacuate during recent flooding. On Thursday, she told me she considered her situation and family, which includes her elderly father. She also looked at what longtime residents said they were doing on community Facebook pages. Devote even talked with the previous owner of the property she owns. Here she is describing how she felt making the decision.
Not evacuating in this flood, I felt the same sick feeling that I had when I did evacuate for the fires. Just questioning, am I making the right decision? Like that sick feeling, that feeling of panic, not knowing what the right, you know, knowing you want to make the right decision for your animals, for your family. Not necessarily in that order, but everybody is our family. You know, the animals are our family. So you want to make sure you're making the right decision for them.
So for residents who chose to stay and not evacuate, and that goes to really like not only flooding, but any disaster, what are some of the dangers of not heeding those orders?
I talked with Yusuf Abul Hassan about that. He's a certified safety professional and an associate professor at Sacramento State teaching classes on emergency preparedness. Abul Hassan says there are immediate risks during flooding, like drowning or getting swept away by rushing water. Flooding has killed an average of 88 people per year over the past 30 years, according to the National Weather Service. And Abul Hassan says there are long-term dangers associated with flooding, too, like sharp objects getting dislodged, damaged gas and power lines, getting electrocuted. There's also diseases spread by mosquitoes to worry about in the aftermath. He also made the point that if your property becomes an island surrounded by water, you might not know when you can get help or safely drive. Overall, he strongly recommends following flooding evacuation orders.
There seems usually in communities a sense of complacency associated with flooding that, oh, it's, you know, not necessarily going to affect me. You know, it might just be people that travel roads and such.
So for those who didn't evacuate, how did they get through the storms?
One person stressed common sense during tough times. Luna, who I mentioned earlier, said he shared some tips with neighbors who asked him. He said he stayed inside and didn't drive at night during rainstorms, which experts recommend because it can be so hard to see. Luna also told people to stay off the roads in general if they aren't familiar with them. Since the power went out for a while, Luna said he was also prepared with canned food and bottled water. But again, Abul Hassan says it's risky to stay when officials issue an evacuation order. There's the risk of running out of food and not knowing how long it will take to get any help.
Did anyone share how they would decide whether to actually evacuate and leave during a potential future evacuation order, especially in a community that has a history of flooding?
A couple people told me they would basically assess their risk again. Dan Coons is a volunteer fire captain with the Wilton Fire Protection District. He's been with the fire district for 17 years and lived in Wilton for more than 30. Coons said he would tell his wife to evacuate if he thinks she needs to. Here he is explaining his thought process.
I'm going to stay because of work, sure. But I would get her out if I was that concerned of it. But being with the fire district, we knew what the you know, what the levee district was telling people, and we just weren't concerned about it.
Yeah, so you really got a very good understanding of a unique community in Sacramento County. What were your takeaways following your reporting?
Again, a flooding evacuation order means there is an immediate threat to life. Emergency experts and officials strongly recommend leaving when you get an evacuation order. Staying means if you need help, first responders might not be able to reach you. Also, it's only mid-January, so we've still got a few months of the rainy season left. You can sign up for Sacramento County Emergency Alerts at sacramento-alert.org. And you can find my digital article about Wilton evacuation order experiences on CAP Radio's website.
Kristen, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That is CAP Radio reporter Kristen Lamb sharing their reporting about the Sacramento community of Wilton and why some residents chose not to evacuate following orders due to flooding. Up next, in response to a series of these winter storms we've all been through, President Biden will be visiting California this week following his approval of a major disaster declaration for some counties. Both FEMA and the Small Business Administration join us about the resources that are available. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. President Biden will be in California tomorrow to assess storm damage across the state. The price tag from a series of deadly and destructive atmospheric rivers is too soon to tally. Still, with a major disaster declaration by President Biden, federal resources are available for residents in Sacramento, Santa Cruz, and Merced counties. And just last night, Monterey, Santa Barbara, and San Luis Obispo counties were added to the declaration. But what exactly does that mean? For those recovering from the storms, there are resources to help. But historically, navigating federal assistance after a disaster can be stressful and emotionally taxing in an already difficult time. We have two experts to explain how things work on the federal level. Renee Bafalis is with the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA for short, to explain how the declaration process works and how residents can apply for those lifeline emergency services. And Burl Kelton is with the Small Business Administration, SBA, and explains the resources available for businesses, including loan assistance. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Renee, I want to start with you. About a week and a half ago, on January 8th, President Biden approved an emergency declaration, and then just this weekend, on January 14th, the president approved a major disaster declaration for the six counties I mentioned. How do these disaster declarations differ in terms of the resources that are available?
Well, the original declaration that you spoke of on the 8th, that frees up funds for government officials to be able to deal with emergency measures. So that was for that particular operation. Then on the 14th, it allowed for individuals and for public assistance, which is a government-to-government assistance, to also go into effect for three counties. And then last night, three additional counties were added to that process.
Great. So a total of six counties are now included. There's also the Stafford Act, and that's been around since 1988 for moments like these, federal disaster relief and emergency assistance. Walk us through how that works.
Well, what happens initially is once a disaster occurs, the state and the local officials will do damage assessments to determine the capacity of the damages and to determine whether or not it's beyond the capacity of the state to handle. If it does prove to be that, then that information is referred on to FEMA, and then they refer it on to the White House to make a determination as to whether they move forward with the federal declaration. That is what has happened in this situation. Additional counties have also been added to that list. They've requested assistance, but those counties are continuing to do disaster damage assessments in those areas. So as those assessments are completed and the state makes a determination whether they need to be forwarded on, then they would possibly be added to that declaration as well.
And this declaration is kind of like a fluid document, because what started as three counties, Sacramento, Santa Cruz, and Merced, has been extended to Monterey, Santa Barbara, and San Luis Obispo counties, but the impact of these storms aren't exclusive to these six counties. If you're not included in these six counties, is there the possibility that more counties will be incorporated?
Yes, as those damage assessments are completed in those counties and provided then on to us, then we'll make the determination as to whether or not we move forward. But yes, there are many more counties that are also in that process. Mm.
When I was covering the aftermath of the campfire in Butte County, in Paradise and surrounding communities, I remember there being like a one-stop shop for disaster assistance, because it can be a very complicated process. So is or will there be such a thing for these series of storms?
Yes, we have disaster recovery centers that will be opening in the coming days for folks within the communities that are affected and that have been declared. We want to make sure that those centers are within those communities so that folks don't have very far to travel, so that if they've lost transportation or a way to get there, we want to make sure that they're accessible.
Are there agencies or teams that are helping people fill out these applications?
Yes, we will have staff available at those facilities, but we also have disaster survivor assistance teams that are in several communities now throughout the state, working at different sites, also going door to door very soon, and they will have iPads with them, and they will be able to register folks on site. But we also ask, if you're in any of the six communities that have already been declared, you need to register with FEMA. The first step I want to stress is, if you have insurance, please contact your insurance companies. We need to make sure that they have that you let us know that you have insurance. We cannot duplicate what your insurance companies may cover. However, if you are underinsured or uninsured, we will probably be able to assist you in some way. So we want you to register with us. You can do that in a couple of ways. You can call our 1-800-621-3362 number or go on to disasterassistance.gov, register that way. And again, our disaster survivor assistance teams will be in the communities and we'll be able to register you on site.
What are some of the documents, receipts, or even images a resident should gather?
Well, we really stress that if you are making any repairs, if you have any photos, please keep your receipts, keep your photos, provide whatever information you have to us when you register. We also will have an inspector come out to your property to document the damages. And at that time, you have additional information. Say you've spoken with a contractor and you have an estimate. Please provide that as well. That the more information we have, the more able we are to serve you.
So get the ball rolling on that stuff ahead of time.
Absolutely. And to register, you need things like your Social Security number, proof of ownership of your property, or if you're a renter, proof of, you know, something from your landlord that you were living in that property, that type of information. And if you've lost documentation, we should be able to assist you in retrieving some of that information.
Given that FEMA has been offering this type of assistance in disasters going back decades, what are some of the common mistakes people can make?
Well, it's not so much mistakes. It's just that sometimes when you're filling out an application, you're not thorough enough, so that maybe we need more information from you, or maybe, again, if you have insurance, we have to wait till your insurance comes through, so we can't duplicate what your insurance may cover. So many times you will receive information from us saying that maybe you have been temporarily denied assistance. But that is not the end of the road. That is really the beginning of the process. Please make sure if you receive a letter like that, you read it thoroughly to find out what the reasons are, because it may just be that, you know, you've transposed some numbers. Maybe your Social Security number is wrong. Maybe the information is incomplete. We need more information. Or, again, we're waiting for your insurance to come through. So please make sure, don't take that, you know, initial letter from us as that. Go through the whole process. The other thing I do want to stress, FEMA's role in these kinds of operations is to help people get back on their feet, to help them in the initial recovery process. And our partner agency, which Beryl is with, is SBA, they're there to sort of get you back to where you were before the storm hit. So it's a real partnership between the two agencies.
Mm. You know, when you mentioned, you know, just making sure you're reading the documents from start to finish, what if there are language barriers?
We have translations. We also have translators, operators, either on site at one of our recovery centers. Our disaster survivor assistance teams also have bilingual folks, and our operators have multifaceted languages capability.
When thinking about all these resources, from, you know, multiple languages to having teams that go out and help individuals file and fill out these applications, how has FEMA learned and improved over the decades?
We have been able to sort of streamline things because we know that these times are very difficult for folks when you've lost your home and lost your documents and everything else. To add another piece of paperwork to this process is difficult. That's why we make sure that we have teams in the field that are there to assist you, especially in the recovery centers, because they give you a place to go to meet with someone face-to-face who will become your advocate, who will get to know your situation personally and be able to help you through the process. Many times they can help you write appeal letters, all those types of things. So we really encourage people to use those facilities and to work with our people in the field.
When do you think those centers will be up and running?
We're hoping in the coming days. We just had these counties come online in the last few days. So we're working very hard to get them up and running in the next week or so.
You know, we're talking about paperwork and applications, but in the immediacy, how does FEMA help local agencies and state agencies help residents with other resources and assistance?
Well, we work very closely with nonprofit agencies, and so we have liaisons who work with them so that if for some reason we are unable to assist, we can refer folks to those agencies for assistance. Also, the counties and the state have facilities and operations available to folks as well, and we are very aware of those and make sure that we refer people to them as well.
And of course, we're talking about recovery and response, but are there proactive resources that FEMA helps with ahead of a disaster to prevent or even mitigate some of that damage that people are now going through?
We do. And we also will have mitigation folks in the field working with folks who are indeed trying to do repairs or trying to mitigate for future disasters. We work very closely with states, provide hazard mitigation funds. Once a disaster is completed and we know really what the damages were and the amounts, they work on a cost, you know, basis with that, and they funnel that money through the state and then back out to the counties for those types of projects.
This may be hard to answer, but when these centers are up and running, how long do you anticipate they'll be open?
They will be open as long as the need is out there. We have no end date. We don't even have an opening date yet, so we don't have any dates set, but we will be here as long as the need persists.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're speaking with FEMA about resources available for residents in six counties included in California's major disaster declaration. Let's now move to Beryl Kelton with the Small Business Administration, or SBA. Beryl, what is the SBA's role in disaster relief?
Good morning, Vicki. Thank you for having me on. The role of the SBA is parallel to FEMA. Actually, the SBA has been around a long time, serving local small businesses all over the country. But the Stafford Act included the disaster assistance side with FEMA. And the purpose of the SBA disaster program is for long-term recovery. So we're looking at a larger amount of money available for folks that are eligible and service over a longer period of time. We also work with businesses very closely in their recovery. And basically, it's kind of like FEMA passes the baton once folks are in the safe, secure, sanitary place to begin their recovery. And then we have direct low-interest federal loans that are available in this presidential declaration for homeowners, renters, nonprofits, and businesses, small businesses. We also have a two-tier system where the declared primary counties that you've mentioned a couple of times are eligible for the full program, which is physical and economic injury, loss or damage. And then the directly adjacent counties to the primary counties, businesses in those counties are eligible for economic injury application or recovery. There's $2 million per applicant available for businesses, $200,000 for homeowners for physical damage, and $40,000 separately for personal property. So the renting survivor would have access to that $40,000 personal property, including vehicles.
Okay, so there's a variety of financial resources available, varying amounts and circumstances. How do you suggest someone who is a business, and a business, that's a big umbrella term because it can be nonprofits, you can be a landlord, you can also be like a brick and mortar business. What are the first steps you recommend for these individuals to navigate what is right for them and what will fit their needs at this time?
Oh, well, it's really critical that each individual register with FEMA first and then apply to SBA. When they make an application to SBA, it's no obligation, no cost. So what we recommend is that they apply, find out what they're eligible for, and then it's up to them to decide what they want to do from there. If they're eligible for the maximum amount, they can take it on a delayed basis, or they can take a portion at a time, or they can just say, I'm not ready. I don't have a contractor. I don't have the materials, the machinery or equipment to recover yet. And we basically put it on abeyance until they can tell us that they're ready for whatever they're eligible for.
Okay, so register with FEMA first before you turn to the SBA.
Right. Now FEMA does not have any programs for businesses. But as an individual, it would be important for them as a survivor to register, because a lot of times farther down the road, a state, and we do everything in this area west of the Mississippi and the islands, Hawaii and farther out. So we're doing, several states, and then there's a center in Alabama. But whatever the case, frequently a state will have a program that is directed at the survivors, but much later on in the recovery. And one of the primary requirements is that they have participated in the federal program that was available. And for this disaster, that means FEMA and SBA.
Hmm. Is insurance required?
And they never have. Pardon me?
Is insurance required to receive assistance? And should a business file a claim first?
If you have insurance, you'll need to find out the information. You do not have to have all that settled before we can actually help you and begin distributing whatever the eligibility is in funds. But it is very important to make that contact with your insurance, find out what your situation is, and let us know. The application is a one-time thing, but we continue to work with the applicant during several months of the recovery and going through the process. It's really important to get started, because there's a 60-day window for application from the date of the declaration, which in this case is March 16th.
Renee, did you want to chime in?
I just wanted to say, if you are an individual homeowner or renter and you are referred to SBA, which a majority of people are, please make sure you complete that application, because if you don't complete the application, it stops the process right there. If you complete the application and for some reason you are not eligible for that SBA loan, they will refer you back to FEMA for a second look. So please make sure you complete that process.
Mm. When Burl was talking about a 60-day window, does that apply to FEMA as well?
It does.
Okay.
Yes.
So, Burl, in addition to business loans, I mean, SBA offers a variety of resources as we're learning. I mean, what are some of the big things that can cause delays in receiving relief?
I think probably some of the biggest is not staying in contact with the agency. In other words, if FEMA is offering you a certain amount of recovery funds, but they don't know how to get a hold of you, then you lose right there. Or with the business, if we don't have good contact information or we have documentations of the ownership of the business, then that will delay whatever our processing is. Interesting thing too about, you mentioned renters or folks that have locations where they own the property, but they have someone that's occupying the property. SBA looks at serving both the owner and the occupant, but separately. So you might live in a condo or a homeowners association, and the homeowners association is a business, and we serve them in the area that they're responsible for. But then the occupant, even if they own that building, frequently owns only a portion of the physical property. We like to say in a condo, The occupant owns from the walls in, and the homeowners association or the condo association owns from the walls out. So it's really important to know what your relationship is to where you're living in that case, so that we know how to serve both people. And we do that. We've been doing that for many, many years now. And all the time, it's a year-round activity, because we have disasters all over the country all the time and in different ways, but we're there to serve. We have actually five different levels of disasters that we can respond to that are not residential. So we're doing things like that all the time. Mm. Apartment fires, explosions, earthquake, floods, all kinds of things like that. But we need to get the information of how to contact you and keep in touch with you, and then make sure that the financial information you provide can show that you can take on this additional debt and still maintain your manner of living. So that's important both for businesses in operation and homeowners and renters in terms of looking at their recovery and their eligibility.
Now, if I could just say on FEMA's individual assistance side, our funds are grants. We do not have to be paid back. So they're an initial jump start to your recovery process. And they can include things such as rental assistance if indeed your insurance doesn't pay for that, lodging. So if you had to stay at a hotel or something, keep all your receipts. Make mm-hmm. sure you've documented everything. Home repairs, personal property losses, damage to vehicles, child care, medical and dental expenses, maybe funeral expenses. Those types of things are what we focus on.
So, so, so important, and such an important conversation, because as I'm learning from both of you, there is a lot to sift through, and it's very circumstantial and depending on each individual's circumstance and experience. Renee and Burl, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having us.
If we have a minute, Vicki, I just found out that we are opening a DRC with FEMA today, this afternoon in Galt at 600 Sherbola Avenue in Galt. And we'll be down there this afternoon after 2 o'clock with FEMA and the other representatives as the start of the public service, face-to-face service that we'll offer for folks. And the 800 number for SBA is 800-659-2955, and that's nationwide. We have folks that are experienced and an expert. They'll talk to you if you have any questions, and we'd be glad to help folks if they have other questions.
Thank you so much, and we'll have more information on that center, which is opening up in Galt in Sacramento County, on CAP Radio. Once again, thank you so much, Renee and Burl with FEMA and the SBA.
Thank you, Vicki.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. It's a journey of self-identity spanning the world's largest ocean, a personal voyage to overcome mental illness and grief that comes with the loss of one's culture. That is the basis of Aloha Vietnam, a novel about a Vietnamese-American family's odyssey through the world of mental health treatment and navigating life in a new country as they cope with leaving their homeland. The novel is a first, written by Dr. Elizabeth Nguyen, a psychiatrist based in Davis. The book is a love offering to the land and the people of her cross-cultural heritage, Vietnam and Hawaii. She hopes this novel can help heal the wounds of generational trauma and be a beacon of hope to those suffering from mental illness. Dr. Nguyen joins us now, but the healing power of art and nature. Good morning.
Good morning, Vicki. So grateful to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, lovely having you as well. I mean, as we mentioned, the name of your novel is Aloha Vietnam. Can you share with our listeners a quick synopsis of what this book is about and what compelled you to write it?
I would love to. So Aloha Vietnam is a novel, and I wrote a novel because I wanted to tell a story, because storytelling heals. Sharing our stories brings healing to us and others, especially around topics where there might be shame and stigma, such as trauma or mental illness. So like you already shared, Aloha Vietnam is the story of a Vietnamese-American refugee family leaving their motherland of Vietnam after the war in 1975 and settling onto the shores of Honolulu, Hawaii to start a new life in a new land and a new culture. But it's also the story of how their family navigates their adolescent daughter Aang's bipolar diagnosis and her mental health treatment and recovery. You know, not everyone writes a book, but everyone has a story. And stories aren't perfect. People aren't perfect. They're real. Life isn't perfect. It's messy. It's painful. But it's also beautiful and inspiring. And that's why I wrote this story, to bring light and awareness to the many stories of mental illness that don't get shared, that don't get spoken and seen. And I wanted to really create a heroine for this mental health journey that people can really get behind and see themselves. And, you know, everyone in this life knows someone or personally has gone through mental health experiences. So I really wanted to decrease the stigma around mental health and mental illness.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, this book is a novel, technically fiction, but it's also loosely based on your own experience growing up as a Vietnamese-American family in Hawaii. How did that shape your career in psychiatry, especially as you mentioned, there's long been a stigma surrounding mental health?
Yeah, you know, I get asked this question a lot, and I like to say, like, people always ask me, like, who are you in the book? And I like to say that there's a piece of me in every character in the book, because I hope that everyone sees a piece of themselves in different characters in the book. And it doesn't even matter sort of like who is who. It's about really sharing our personal experiences. So this story is deeply personal to me, because I bring from it all of my personal experiences growing up in Hawaii in a Vietnamese American refugee family. And as now a psychiatrist working closely with patients on this mental health journey. And And that has informed my journey as a cross-cultural psychiatrist. I really feel like mental illness is so hard for anyone, but especially when there's an added layer of cultural complexity, when you're dealing with terms and diagnoses that some cultures don't even have the language for.
Yeah. I mean, and according to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Asian Americans are less likely to receive mental health treatment in this country compared to those of other racial or ethnic backgrounds. I mean, I have a background being Japanese, my mother and grandma are, and I can definitely identify with that. That resonates with me. But you're also a psychiatrist. What do you believe are some of the biggest barriers to treatments and reaching out for support within the AAPI community?
Yeah, so there's so many different barriers. I think first and foremost, there's just a lack of understanding around mental illness of when mental health struggles come out. This is not something that we talked about growing up in our family and in culture. There was no understanding of depression or bipolar or schizophrenia or anxiety or post-traumatic stress disorder. And so these symptoms that people exhibit become misattributed or seen as personal failings or family failures that are very shameful that need to be hidden away. And so there's a lack of just even understanding and awareness of mental health symptoms and the treatments available. And then I think there's a stigma. There's still a lot of stigma across culturally around mental illness being seen as a personal failure. And that is just not true.
And this also comes at a time for many people with an immigrant background, a time of survival and just trying to figure out a new language, a new home, and also grappling with whether you want to or not, the loss of what you're leaving behind.
Yeah, and exactly. And as a cross-cultural psychiatrist working with diverse communities, so much of mental health struggles actually comes from not dealing with loss and grief. Unprocessed loss and grief leads to so much downstream mental health struggles. And so really allowing people to share their stories of loss and grief and trauma and transitions actually alleviates many downstream mental health struggles.
Yeah, I mean, these don't usually happen at a relaxing time in one's life, right? Where there's a lot of space, you know, to devote to this, especially if you weren't taught to do that. And getting to that generational aspect, the two main characters in your book, or two of the main characters, are teenager, a Vietnamese-American teenager, as well as her mother, and the teenager struggles with bipolar disorder. And her mother not only is struggling coming to terms with this mental health diagnosis, but also just wrestling with the cultural challenges as an immigrant, trying to bridge culture and traditions of her home country to her new home in Hawaii. Why was it important to tell both stories in this book?
Oh, it was so important because I feel that the generational misunderstandings between parents and their children, especially in immigrant families, is one of the biggest chasms of pain and loss and sadness. And when I work with families with cultural histories, it's the raising their family in a new culture is so hard for parents and children to navigate. And so working with families, that has always been one of my biggest goals and desires and privileges, is to help parents and children understand one another's experiences and stories. And just even from that understanding alone can come so much healing. I mean, I really want to advocate for people with mental health struggles to get treatment, because treatment works. But this book, my book, is really about showing that even just opening up stories to bring understanding to one another, even within the same family, can bring so much healing. And there's so many avenues for healing. And sharing our stories through art and writing is one that everyone can access.
Yeah, and that's something that you have clearly done with your novel. And as a psychiatrist, I mean, you also even advocate for water as being healing, and also reconnection to the natural world. In the last minute that we have, you know, walk us through that approach.
Yeah, I think being born and raised in Hawaii, my connection to the ocean, the Pacific Ocean, is a soul level connection. And I think everyone drawn to the water knows how much their love for water is healing for them. It makes them just feel peaceful and loved. And I bring that energy into my work with clients to let them know that that their love for the water, their love for the ocean, their love for the natural world is a healing, soothing, calming balm and resource for all the pain and struggles that we all go through as humans. The natural world is always there to hold us and take care of us. And it's important that we take care of her and our planet and our waters as well.
Well, on that note, Dr. Nguyen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Vicky.
Dr. Elizabeth Nguyen is a psychiatrist and author of the novel Aloha Vietnam. Dr. Nguyen is also hosting a book signing event in Davis next month. We have more information to that on our Insight page as well as the novel. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Carell Martinez, with managing editor Arm Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.